I'm John Kroll. On today's No Limits, we're going to talk about changing social programs to include work requirements. Indiana has done this with HIP 2.0, and there have been other federal pushes in recent months. My guests are Jessica Frazier, director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families, the Reverend Shonda Gladden, and Kayla Dyer, community organizer with Faith in Indiana. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. Today on No Limits, we're going to be talking about changing social programs so that they include work requirements, specifically and including healthcare coverage, HIP 2.0 in this state. This is a complex subject. We're going to talk about it in depth. We would invite your participation and questions. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Jessica Frazier. She is director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families, the Reverend Shonda Gladden, and Kayla Dyer, a community organizer, community health organizer with Faith in Indiana. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks so much.
And I guess I should say welcome back to Jessica, since she's the veteran on the program.
Thanks, we've got John. A couple of newbies.
Let's talk about first what a work requirement is. And I will start with Jessica on that one.
Sure. So a work requirement is when there is a state or federal policy that requires a participant in a social benefit program to complete some sort of work or work-like activity in order to receive their benefits. So, for example, we've had work requirements in the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family program since welfare reform in 1996. There are work requirements in the Nutrition Assistance Program and stricter ones being proposed in the House Farm Bill right now. And then with the new waiver application for HIP 2.0, Indiana is one of a few states introducing work requirements into Medicaid coverage.
And Kayla, I'll throw the next one to you. What do these work requirements look like? I mean, what specifically are we requesting people to do, or not requesting, demanding that people do?
So we're demanding that people work at least 20 hours a week. And from what I understand, as opposed to 20 hours a week collectively throughout the month, it must be met within the week, which means that if someone has a sick day and they're unable to make it up, then they will lose their coverage. Did I get that right, Jessica?
You Not are quite. Confusing it with the House Farm Bill. That's
you know
in the
what?
House Farm
I've
Bill.
I've been
There's
studying
so many.
That so much.
It's so hard. So
okay. So,
cover me.
All right, Jessica, we'll throw it back to you.
Cover me. So the waiver for Healthy Indiana is that they're going to look back the previous year, and you will have had to complete your work requirements in 8 of the 12 months. So that's the HIP one.
Okay. And I presume, and I'll throw this to the Reverend Gladden, I presume that there is a way for a person to say, I am incapacitated and cannot work. Is that the case?
I certainly believe that's the case, but I am not the expert as it pertains to the actual work requirements. I'm really here because as a pastor, my members will be impacted by this, and it pretty much goes against everything we read in the Bible as it pertains to requiring work for some type of benefit.
Okay. So is there a way for
So there are. There are a healthy number of exemptions to Indiana's waiver application. If you are students, if you are a pregnant woman, if you are a primary caregiver, if you are enrolled in substance use disorder treatment, if you are homeless, if you are already doing work requirements because of SNAP and TANF, there's a few others that I'm sure I'm missing, but there is a healthy list of exemptions. However, you know, that brings up its own concerns about whether or not they'll be consistently and fairly administered.
And I should say that we invited a representative from FSSA to be on this program. They were not able to make the scheduling work, even to call in. But they did want to communicate some information. They said that the work requirements will start in January of 2019. They won't be fully implemented until 2020. The Gateway to Work program will try to help people connect with jobs. Hoosiers on HIP 2.0 will have many ways to be exempt. Like if they work, volunteer, or are in school, and there will be flexibility as the program ramps up. Does that all square with your understanding, Jessica? Well, I'll let everyone speak to that. Is that square with everybody's understanding of the way the program is supposed to work?
Yeah, that's what I understand.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you, you know, most people are going to think, well, you know, requiring people to work, not such a horrible idea out there. It's been a buzzword, and believe me, I'm going to play to some degree devil's advocate here because I know the history on this, that in fact workfare programs often end up being far more expensive than welfare programs and far less efficient and end up being a far greater burden on the taxpayer. But I'm going to ask, and I will start with the Reverend Gladden on this one. Is this a good idea or a bad idea, and why?
Thanks so much. It really sounds like our country is taking three steps back when we make these types of requirements on people. That as a pastor, I am very clear that Bible suggests to me that if you don't work, you don't eat. So we're not suggesting that people ought not work. But to make a social benefit available to people based on a work requirement really is quite morally wrong. That people who are incapacitated, people who are in need of benefits, the laborers who came to the vineyard to work in Jesus's parable of the laborers, they were not treated differently based on the time of work that they put in. And so I don't believe that a social benefit of this, a work requirement of this type to give people a benefit of a social benefit squares with our reading of the gospel and as people who are called to be moral.
Kayla, good idea, bad idea, and why?
I think the work requirement is addressing a separate issue than health care, quite honestly. And I do agree with the Reverend that it should not be required. Can I give my personal story? Would that be all right?
Show's called No Limits for a Reason.
No Limits, all right. So ever since I was 12, I've had a job. No gaps, right? Mm. I have a master's degree. I've done a lot of service in the community as being a missionary in my former life. And last year, my wife and I had to move from New Hampshire to here for her health reasons. And in the midst of her pregnancy, had to file for Medicaid. She's a social worker, so she knows the ins and outs of Medicaid expansion. The current system as it stands is complicated to navigate. And for oversight of a document, she was denied Medicaid being pregnant. And so it took multiple phone calls to write that. And thankfully, it was righted. And the people that she worked with in the call centers, they were wonderful people. They were good. But the system in and of itself is complicated. Even internally, it's just not efficient. And so things do get lost. And so I really think that we owe it to are people who are in need a simpler process. And I believe that the work requirement complicates the process. It's a process that will have to lay over thousands of people when we already have a system that's complicated and imperfect.
Jessica, good idea, bad idea, and why?
So, bad idea.
Okay.
You know, we have sort of cascading concerns about work requirements in general and with healthcare in particular. You know, to Kayla's point, the system is complicated and human beings make errors and make mistakes. And the thing that's so troubling and frightening about HIP is that it's healthcare and people can die if humans make mistakes. And so, you know, we know from our work that the impact of work requirements in other programs has been to large scale kick people off of programs. And we understand that's not the motivation here. And that's not the, you know, the desire. Secretary Walthall has assured Kayla and I actually together that her goal is zero suspensions. However, people are human and they make mistakes and the system is complicated. And so we're concerned about that. To your point earlier, John, it is going to be more expensive because there are major barriers to work. These are very low income people. If they're not working, there's probably a host of reasons why, including the fact that childcare is the same as IU tuition and transportation is expensive and they may not have skills. So getting them ready to work is going to be very expensive. And in the meantime, sick folks could not get care.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about adding work requirements to many social programs. We're using sort of as the hinge discussion point. The work requirements for HIP 2.0 or healthcare coverage here in Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Jessica, I'm going to stay with you then. And I'm going to ask you to step across the line and try to speak to what was the motivation for this change then? What is driving it?
Sure. Well, I don't want to put motivations and ideas in people's head, but I do think that there is a desire to...
What was expressed to you, presumably, then when you were lobbying on it?
Okay. So, you know, what was expressed to us is that, you know, they want to help families get to work so that they can improve their circumstances. And I do know that the state has been very concerned about our labor force participation rate. There has been a real effort to try to look at who have dropped out of the labor force and figure out how to get them back in, which I think is a noble effort. But work requirements themselves, again, don't do anything to address the barriers to employment that people are facing. It's a stick mechanism and not a carrot mechanism or a figuring out why and then putting those solutions in place.
What do they hope this will accomplish, Kayla?
They hope that people will, how I interpreted it, that people would lift themselves out of a poverty situation with labor supports around them. But I'm not sure how much lifting can be done of oneself. In my opinion, healthcare is a support that people do need in order to get up on their feet without an additional requirement.
Well, and the Reverend Gladden, I think speaking to one of your earlier points here to some degree, and picking up on some of the work that actually Jessica's organization has done, we've seen an anomaly here in our history in that unemployment rates actually are pretty low in Indiana, but at the same time, poverty rates have increased. And that confounds a lot of traditional thinking because, at least in the past, the thought was the closer you get to full employment, the more you do to eliminate poverty. That doesn't seem to be working right now. What effect will this have on that dynamic?
the reality is that many people are actually working, as you said. And so the work requirements will make it harder for most adult beneficiaries because they're already working. The challenge we have is a living wage. And so if you're working but you're not making enough, you're working multiple jobs and multiple shifts, to add additional hardship in terms of burden of proof to, that you are worthy of health care in a country that is supposed to be a leader of the free world just seems asinine and completely contrary to the work that we ought to do together.
We are talking about new changes to Indiana law, federal law, adding work requirements to many social programs, including health care coverage. Here in Indiana, that would be HIP 2.0. If you want to join this conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Jessica Fraser. She is director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families, the Reverend Shonda Gladden, and Kayla Dyer, a community health organizer with Faith in Indiana. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about changes that implement work requirements for many social programs, including health care coverage here in Indiana, that is HIP 2.0. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Jessica Fraser. She is director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families, the Reverend Shonda Gladden, and Kayla Dyer. I'm sorry, Kayla Walker actually is a student of mine. Kayla Dyer, community organizer with Faith in Indiana. Again, if you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Jerry has done and call us at 866-476-3881. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Certainly.
I haven't heard the whole program, but was listening for the last 15 minutes or so, and understand that the guests that you have all seem to be very opposed to this program, which kind of surprises me. You know, I understand the systems are complicated, but aren't many of these folks already in a complicated system? So, you know, they've learned to navigate that. They'll learn to navigate the new system. And there are exemptions for people who can't work. So it's not forcing people who can't work to go along with the 20 hours a week or whatever it is. And for those who can work, isn't it a positive because, you know, a sense of self-worth maybe, you know, puts them on a different trajectory and helps them in the long run. So I guess I'm surprised to hear that everyone is so opposed to it. And as far as following the Bible or the gospel, that's not how this country is ruled. We're ruled by laws, and I don't feel like, you know, of course, we all want to do the right thing. We want to treat people with respect and dignity. But I don't think that that should be how this decision is made.
Thank you very much for the call and the question. I want to reiterate, since you didn't hear part of it, we did invite someone from FSSA to come on and defend the program. They could not make the schedules work, even to do a phone in. So that's part of the reason that we have speakers on one side, and I'm going to give them a chance to respond right now. Kayla, I'll start with you. Thanks again for the call, Jerry.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, thank you, John, and thank you, Jerry, for your question. I think it's a worthy one and one that thousands of people do ask every day. I do believe that there is a sense of self-worth in one who does work. Like I mentioned before, I've been working since I was 12 without a day gap. And I'm perhaps on the extreme side that my self-worth is comes through my work. But back to your question, I believe that there are thousands of people who are in the middle of attempting to navigate and in the midst of all of the other struggles that they're going through, be it financial, health, or otherwise, or family stresses. I think that a social service can be of relief, and a social service that is simpler can be of relief so that other pieces, so that there can be energy put forth to those other pieces. I can't remember the other piece of your question. Did I answer that sufficiently?
Well, she made a point also about how, you know, work actually could enhance a person's sense of belonging to the community and feeling that she or he had earned her or his way, that it added some dignity to the experience.
Oh, right,
sure. Too.
Of course. Thank you, John. And
sure.
Also the idea of why a faith community might be concerned about this as well. So belonging to the community and work, I think that is a value, but I don't think that it fits within the context of earning health care. I think without speaking along faith lines, I think that we have a moral, we should have a moral compass that encompasses our neighbor who just is not making it. And I really don't believe that we have a scarcity. I think we're taught to believe that there is a scarcity of resources when we really do. We're the richest country in the nation, so we should be able to live with one another and treat one another and help one another through that abundance.
I've gotten an email from our regular listener, Jerry. And again, if you want to join the conversation by email, you can send us your note at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, frankly, this subject is much too complicated to sort out in less than an hour. As a confirmed socialist, I am convinced that a universal basic income will at some point be recognized as a necessary and just measure to maintain the stability and prosperity of American civilization. Having advanced this radical position, I would also include a strict work requirement for the UBI. I would require recipients to perform the hard work of citizenship. In addition to obeying the laws, recipients would be required to perform such civic obligations as jury duty and voting. I would further require that recipients make informed voting choices and demonstrate more than a superficial knowledge of candidates, their stances on important public issues, and the details of specific propositions that might appear on the ballot. What do your panelists think of my proposed work requirements? Jessica.
Oh, man, there's a lot there.
Yes. Yes.
I can't tackle all of the civic engagement and education pieces, although I do think personally that we have a need for more civic engagement and education, but I'm not an educator of young people, so I'm not an expert in that. But I do want to talk about the universal basic income a little bit, because I think the
which was first advanced years ago by that noted left-wing radical Richard Nixon. But go ahead.
I think we have a long way to go on a proposal like that. And I'll give you the experience here in Indiana of our self-sufficiency standard. For your listeners who don't know, the Institute commissions a self-sufficiency standard, which is the basic needs budget for 472 families in all of Indiana's 92 counties. And it's very interesting when we go to groups and talk about this self-sufficiency standard. When we go to social workers and folks that work with directly work with low-income families, they universally tell us that it's too low. And when we talk to lawmakers about what the self-sufficiency standard is for a family in a county in Indiana, they tell us universally that it's too high. And so getting to what that right number would be and making sure that it's enough to actually care for people's basic needs, I think, would be a real challenge. So I think it's not necessarily a completely out of the realm idea, but it would need a lot of work to try to figure out how to do it in a good way.
We're talking about work requirements for social programs, including healthcare here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Tracy has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Tracy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. I just wanted to give a different perspective.
Certainly.
I am someone who is a recipient of these services. I desperately want to work. It's not about not wanting to work, but I am unable to. But these medicines that I get, they keep me alive. And this isn't just something, you know, that I take casually and that, you know, people have the privilege of being able to debate. This isn't a debate. This is very critical. And I know that I'm not the only person who feels this way, you know. And I think there's this idea that we're just getting free things and we don't want to work. And maybe there's people who do. But for people like me, it's life or death. This is significant and it's terrifying because I don't know what happens to me if I lose my services.
Thank you very much. And obviously, we wish you the best of fortune.
Thank you
very much for sharing your story, Tracy.
Thank you.
The Reverend Gladden.
Tracy, thanks so much, and I want you to know I'm praying for you. Like Tracy, I pastor the church in the heart of Martindale Brightwood, St. Paul AME Church, 46218 zip code here in the city. Like Tracy, many of those persons who live in our neighborhoods would lose services if this was indeed pushed. Why is that the case? Because what the research, the data suggests, is that primary effects of work requirements will be less access to care, worse health outcomes, and less financial security. So if we require people who are desperately trying to work to do more, I really believe we're setting our country up for failure.
Gotten an email from, it's signed just from a social worker. And again, if you want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Social worker writes, in response to the listener, Jerry, I think it is so important to understand that many barriers exist to people working: child care costs, a lack of public transportation, a criminal background, and more play into someone's decision to get back into the workforce. Single mothers and caregivers are disproportionately affected by legislation such as this. A work ethic is great in theory, but doesn't do a whole lot when you are getting paid $9 an hour and can't get daycare that you can afford. I see everybody nodding heads here. So why don't we talk about the people who are likely to be most affected by these changes? And I'll start with the Reverend Gladden, but I want to hear everybody's thoughts on that.
Thanks so much. Yeah, the people most affected would be those people who can't get more hours on a minimum wage job, people who can't afford childcare that's $1,000 a month or more, that there are some people who have fallen into the gaps of underemployment, that these would be the people who would be greatest, who would have the impact that would be the greatest in terms of being hurt by this move.
Jessica.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then also folks with, you know, a lack of work history, they're going to have a hard time finding perhaps a position. Folks that that have those low wage jobs and can't get the transportation, as she said before, you know, they're just going to have a hard time. And then there's also going to be folks that are doing everything right and are hurt by it because administrative errors happen. So in our nutrition assistance program, for example, the negative error rate, that's people who didn't get nutrition assistance but were supposed to, 47% in the month of December of 2017. 47% of the people we didn't give nutrition assistance to were supposed to get it, because mistakes were made. It could have been their mistakes. It could have been the state's mistakes. Somebody made a mistake. That's people not getting food. This is people not getting life-saving medicine or health care.
Kayla.
Yes, I'm going to piggyback on the Reverend's statement of those who are working multiple jobs. And if you're working multiple jobs, most likely those are low-income jobs, which also means there's no time for job training. There's no time to, quite frankly, get what needs to be done in the house. Mm-hmm. And so I think that families are most impacted.
And Jessica, I also want to step back. On these exemptions, I'm presuming that the burden of proof is on the recipient, right? That ultimately, I mean, to use a legal term, but they have to demonstrate that there is a reason they are not working.
Right. We're trying to sort out exactly how the tracking of community engagement is going to work out, because I think it is under development right now by the administration. And so if you have thoughts on that, you should let them know. I think so what I've learned from their documentation is that employment will require documentation, but volunteerism perhaps might be self-attested, which is kind of surprising. That would be a less burdensome way to do it. We would support that. But, you know, I think in the end, even just getting the letter saying you require anything could lead to a lot of people losing services. We saw that with SNAP when we increased the went back to the work requirement on SNAP. When people just got the letter, they thought the letter was telling them that they no longer were eligible, and they just dropped out of the program.
We are talking about adding work requirements to social programs, including health care coverage, which is HIP 2.0 in this state. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Lewis has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Lewis, you're on the air.
Thank you. I am a veteran, so I have VA coverage, so I'm taken care of, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We have one of the most inhumane, brutal, and cruel health care systems among major industrial countries on Earth. If you can afford it, you can have it. If you can't afford it, too bad. Canadians would not be having this discussion, because you're covered from birth until death. I simply don't understand why we here in the United States, when it concerns health care, can be so inhumane. And perhaps the Reverend can correct me on this, but I do not recall after Jesus resuscitated Lazarus, whether Jesus asked Lazarus for a health insurance card or whether he could pay the deductible or the copay. So I think what we need to do is approach this from a humane approach, rather than navigating the system, as I've heard here, and navigating it like the Titanic. So thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. Thanks very much for the call, Lewis. Well, Reverend Gladden, I think since you were queued up there, we'll give you a chance to respond.
Indeed. Thank you for the humorous response and encouragement for us to be humane. What a novel thought that in the United States we'd be invited to be humane. Indeed. The gospel moral imperative does not suggest that people ought to demonstrate some material evidence of their need to be seen as humans, that all of the world religions and even some sects of atheism invite us to take a moral compass that suggests that we treat one another the way we'd like to be treated. I don't believe that any of us would desire to be treated in a way that says we'll determine if you can have access to life-saving opportunities based on whether or not you've worked enough hours this week.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Rojo. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. Rojo writes, even if you have a job, most hourly doesn't provide any health care. Even with a health care plan, the costs will crush most people's livelihood. And it's only going to get worse with baby boomers driving up demand and stressing the system. So, Jessica, I mean, is this, just the beginning of the troubles ahead?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's, you know, this is a good opportunity to bring up some of the other we've hinted at it a little bit, but we haven't talked about some of the other things coming down the pike in terms of federal additions to work requirements. So I think that the point that the listener makes is a valid one. And then this isn't happening in a vacuum. So, you know, housing assistance is going to expand work requirements. There's, you know, the House version of the Farm Bill expands work requirements. So there could be a lot of competing and difficult to navigate systems coming to bear on our most vulnerable citizens.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about changing social programs so that they include work requirements. This would include HIP 2.0, healthcare coverage here in Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866 476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Jessica Fraser. She is director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families, the Reverend Shonda Gladden, and Kayla Dyer, a community organizer with Faith in Indiana. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about changes in social programs so that they include work requirements. This would include HIP 2.0, healthcare coverage here in Indiana. My guests are Jessica Fraser. She is director of the Indiana Institute for Working Families, the Reverend Shonda Gladden, and Kayla Dyer, community organizer with Faith in Indiana. We've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Lisa. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Lisa writes, I have been a clinical social worker for more than 20 years. I would encourage the panel to discuss in greater detail the process one must go through to prove, she puts prove in quote marks, they are disabled, especially those who are disabled due to severe and chronic mental illnesses. Jessica, I'll start with you on that one.
Well, so I don't have the specifics in terms of being federally disabled in front of me. And it's kind of up in the air exactly how the exemptions are going to work on this new HIP waiver. However, they are expanding beyond just the federal definition of disability determination. So enrollees identified as medically frail with serious complex medical conditions will also be included in those who would be exempt. So I don't know if that answers her question exactly, but I think that the normal process, which is very challenging and difficult, there might be some ways that someone wouldn't have to go through that whole process in this particular circumstance.
Gotten an email from a listener named Graham. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Graham writes, my fiance is on HIP 2.0. Over a year ago, they told her to have all her teeth pulled, which she did. Now, nearly 2 years later, she still has no teeth. Before they add more barriers, the current system needs fixed. She also received life-sustaining meds on top of this. So like the caller said, it's nice if you feel you can debate, but those who depend on it, there is no debate. They need it to live. I'm seeing affirmation here from a lot of people in here, but you know, head nods don't work all that well on radio. Yeah. So I actually need somebody to say something.
Well, sure.
At this point, yeah.
Go ahead, Kayla.
Oh, I was going to say, with everyone who is in support of what we are seeing here on the panel, there are thousands more. I do want to let you know there are thousands more around the state. I work for Faith in Indiana, which is a catalyst for faith communities and marginalized people to act collectively for racial and economic justice. And all threaded through there is this issue of health care. We believe in strong families. We believe that families belong together and we care for each other. But our Faith in Indiana chapters expand to Allen, Lake, Hamilton, Elkhart, Marion, and St. Joseph counties. And we partner with Indiana's 17 largest denominations, including the Catholic Archdiocese. And like I said, for those who are listening and hearts hurting and minds kind of in a whirlwind, you're not alone. There are thousands around this state, and collectively, we will care for one another.
I just want to jump in there also and say that, you know, many of us in the advocate community have submitted public comments. We've met with officials from FSSA and the governor's office, and what we've said to them is, we think that what your end goals are not
objectionable. You want more thriving Hoosier families. We all want that. But the way that this is going to be administered, we're just very concerned that someone losing life-saving medicine like insulin or something like that is too great a cost for what you're trying to accomplish. So let's walk it back. Let's take a minute and let's think if there's a better way we can accomplish these things. And so, you know, what we've heard from them is that they're going to take roadshows in the community. I'm not sure how you get touched in with that. Maybe you guys can put something on your website. But, you know, they need to hear from you. They need to hear from people about how this is going to impact their lives.
Well, I can tell you right now, just from the level of listener interest, we've got the calls and I've got a bunch of emails. This conversation is going to continue far beyond what we have time for on the air. So I would invite the three of you and all of our listeners to continue this discussion on our Facebook page at No Limits WFYI. There'll be an opportunity to continue the discussion. In the meantime, though, if you want to join the discussion, you can call us at 866-476-3881 as a listener named Bert has done. Bert, you're on the air.
Yes, I this is No Limits, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay, very good. You know, whoever proposed this needs to be tarred and feathered to run out of the state. You know, that's my first comment. Secondly, it was tried under the Clinton welfare reform. You know, if you don't check out your past, you're doomed to repeat it. This was called the Impact Program, and it was tried under the Clinton Welfare Reform Act. And, you know, there were people supposed to work and playing cards all day long, watching movies, playing cards. It just didn't work. Now, I'm totally paralyzed. I'd be glad to work, and I'm sure that there's something I can do, you know, in this program to make a living, because I'm living off of disability, you know, by taking shrapnel in my back during the war, fighting for this country. Now, you know, I'm sure that these workers, you know, they have goodness in their heart, and I believe that. Love is the only way. And I believe that your panel has love in their heart for everyone. That's the only way, you know. And if they have Christ, they have love in their heart, because Christ is about love. Now, it didn't work. I'm telling you, it did not work. Impact program did not work under the Clinton administration.
Okay,
it didn't
Bert.
Work. Now, you know, this country needs to go into the industrial. They need to join the rest of the industrialized world. This is the only country in the world. I keep hearing the richest country in the world. The richest country. That's a damn lie. If it's the richest country in the world, why can't they have universal health care for everyone like every other developed industrialized country has?
Okay, Bert, let me step in here and let give our panel a chance to respond to your points. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. Reverend Gladden, thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, Bert is very passionate, and I can understand why. It sounds like he's fought for our country, and our country, we say we have so many rights. And as a state, we're adamant about fighting for the right to life. But then once people get here, we don't really fight for rights to sustain that life. It seems as though we offer a number of barriers to people actually living. We make it harder and harder for people to live, and it's not right.
Jessica.
I'd like to jump on his point about the Impact Program, because he's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. That program did not work. We've had between 80 and 90% reduction in TANF participation since welfare reform in 1996. I have a whiteboard in my office, and every month I put the number of TANF adults on that program. And in April of 2018, it was 2,116 adults, 426 of them participating in the Impact Program. The program doesn't have value, and people know that. It's not working. And that's why we're afraid of this, because we've been there.
We are talking about work requirements for social programs, including health care. I have got a lot of phone calls stacked up and a bunch of emails and other questions. I'm going to try to synthesize some here. How much of this, I'm going to take a couple of emails from our regular listener, Kenny, and then one from a listener named Alexander, to deal with the subject of whether part of the problem is that we just don't see health care as a human right. I'll start with Kayla, but I'm going to give everybody, but I'm going to ask our panelists also to be tight in their answers because I want to give as many people as possible a chance to join the discussion, given the levels of interest here.
Yeah, I think John saw my head nod the biggest. Mm-hmm. Is our problem that we do not see healthcare as a human right? I believe with the work ethic and if you work hard enough, you will succeed narrative that we've been taught all of our lives, or at least all of my life, I think that feeds into the narrative that healthcare is not a human right. But I do believe that it is, and it's taken me years to understand that. So yes, I believe that part of the issue is what we have been taught all of our lives regarding how we treat one another, and I'll repeat, if we work hard enough, we will be cared for, or we can take care of ourselves.
Reverend Gladden.
That healthcare is not a human right is very evident in the numerous systemic opportunities that we present for people to be disenfranchised, period.
Jessica.
I think they said it the best, but I would say beyond healthcare too, also paid family and medical leave, sick days, a host of work support benefits that families should have are not rights in this country.
We are talking about work requirements for social programs, including healthcare. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Susan has done and call us at 866-476-3881. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Susan Jo Thomas, and I am friends with the folks on your panel. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Thank you, Sisters in the Struggle, for telling our story today. As an individual, I can tell you that it's difficult to understand how one more burden to the eligibility process for any social service is the right thing to do. But I'm speaking today with my work hat on, and I'm the executive director of Covering Kids and Families, and we work in the communities to help folks navigate through the application and enrollment process into the HIP program. So what I asked to speak to you about today, first, if I could jump in on the woman who was asking, the clinical social worker who was worried about how they would prove disability. Mm-hmm. The medically frail designation is done through claims data. So in theory, if the person is active in treatment and is getting enough of, their diagnoses are showing up on their claims, those are sufficient to validate the medically frail designation. So just wanted to throw that out there. And then also, from Covering Kids' standpoint, the work requirement or the community engagement requirement is here. It's part of our demonstration waiver. We're going to have to comply with it. So it's most important for us at this point to just educate and support Hoosiers as they try to comply with this program. I think that's the most important message that I am asking to be told today, is that if folks are not compliant with this community engagement, there's a serious, serious consequence, and that's called lockout. And that's not something that we've talked about today on the program, but lockout means that you're ineligible for the program for another 6 months. And that, to me, is the message that we have to act quickly to get the word out to everyone to how to comply, support them in ways to comply. The FSSA has promised us that there will be community partners able to help the clients get their compliance, mm-hmm. I guess, documentation in, and we need to hold them to that word.
Thank you very much for the call and for sharing that information, Susan.
Can I give a reply to Susan?
Sure.
Susan, thank you so much for that information. I think it's very informative to our community. And I have a brainstorm question for you.
Actually, she's off the line.
Oh, yeah. She's off the line.
Yeah.
And then I'll make it rhetorical for our...
The way our system works is things clear as soon as so that another caller can come in.
Thank you, John.
Sure.
So the person who needs a diagnosis of frailty, they need that documented. If they don't have health care, how can they prove it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I'll toss another question that occurs out of this, given that, you know, she raises the prospect of lockout and we're worried about, you know, the complications in the system and you know, the dangers of making mistakes, you know, for lack of a better term. Obviously, this can indicate I spent way too much of my life around lawyers. But what is or is there an appeal process? Jessica.
You know, I don't know what they're laying out for the appeal process yet, because our conversation we had with them yesterday is the details are under development. I'm sure there will be an appeal process. But I did want to jump on the point she made about getting the word out to folks, because we had this experience with SNAP. And what happened was people saw these scary letters and they thought it meant they weren't eligible and they just never showed up for appointments. So if you are out there and you are on HIP 2.0 and you get a letter, you need to go to a church, go to your community center, go to Covering Kids and Families, go to a community action agency, go to someone who might know how to help you navigate this system and see what you can do to either get exempt or get on Gateway to Work so that you don't lose your coverage.
We've gotten a question message from a listener named Jackie via Facebook. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Jackie writes, thank you for discussing this. Great point your guest made about the fact that the system is so complicated. My comment is that many healthcare providers are either going ahead and providing desperately needed services and writing them off when a patient doesn't have healthcare coverage, or providers are simply not working with patients who have state-funded health care. Long-term, this results in a disappearing social support system. Mm-hmm. Thank you again. Kayla, you were nodding your head.
Oh, I was just thinking about my family's challenge to find good health care because of more and more doctors are not accepting state-funded medical care. So the ideal is that the pool of doctors, dentists, et cetera, would increase, but in fact, it's decreasing, and it's harder and harder to find good health care even within the Medicaid system.
So, and we're getting close on time. We're about ready to run out here. So, and I want to leave people with a path to some hope if we can. A lot of what we have talked about is the importance of getting educated on this and figuring out ways to comply with the system, understanding what your rights are. What are the best ways to go about doing that? I'll start with Jessica, but I want to hear everyone's thoughts.
Yeah, I think the best way to do that is look in your community for someone who's a licensed navigator or a community center that provides some type of broad-based case management.
Could you give some examples?
So Southeast Community Services, the John H. Bonner Center, Community Action of Greater Indianapolis. Those are three I can think of off the top of my head. And then I would also say churches.
Okay. That seems to be your cue.
And done. I thank you for that cue, because as a pastor, I want to challenge every pastor in the city of Indianapolis to make sure that we offer space for people to have the information necessary. It's not a difficult task to call up our collaborative partners who work in this industry and say, come help my people so that our people have the help they need.
Kayla, the good news is you've got the last word. The bad news is you've got about 10 seconds to deliver it.
Okay. contact me at Kayla, C-A-Y-L-A, at faithindiana.org. We want to have webinars addressing this issue of enrollment.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Jessica Fraser, Shonda Gladden, and Kayla Dyer. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.